And the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm C.S. Song. Emmanuel Wallerstein has written a number of highly influential books. His recent ones include European Universalism, The Rhetoric of Power, Africa, The Politics of Independence and Unity, and The Modern World System and the Longue Durée. And we're talking about his latest book. It's the fourth volume in his Modern World System series. It's entitled Centrist Liberalism Triumphant, 1789 to 1914. Let's talk about 1848. So this is the year of revolution, massive upheaval throughout most of Europe and beyond, in fact. And yet, the revolutionaries did not in the end achieve many of their objectives, many of their significant objectives. What lessons did the proponents of these three main ideologies draw from the 1848 upheaval? Let's start with the conservatives.
Well, look, the conservatives noticed a very peculiar phenomenon. The uprisings took place in France, in Belgium, in Poland, in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, but they didn't take place in Great Britain. That was very peculiar because Great Britain was the place which for the 20 years before that seemed to have the most radical movements. They had the Chartists and they had basically a kind of active working class. So how come Britain didn't have anything going on? And then, in effect, the British were showing them that appropriate kinds of concessions to groups that were protesting actually vitiated their ability to be so radical. And so the lesson the conservatives drew from it is maybe our really tough line, which was incarnated at that time in Metternich, the Chancellor of Austria, who wanted to take a tough, hard line everywhere against all sorts of groups. And of course, he gets thrown out at this point and so forth. They said, well, you know, maybe the British had the right idea. And we get the rise of what historians later call enlightened conservatism. If you look ahead, it turns out that the enlightened conservatives are ready to go further and faster than the liberals in concessions. The liberals are always kind of a little afraid to carry out their own program. But the conservatives in Great Britain, the biggest advance in suffrage occurs under Disraeli, a conservative prime minister. In France, where we have Napoleon III comes in as a kind of conservative, repressive figure, he's also begins to make the greatest concessions, re-legitimating trade unions and so forth. In Germany, if you move a little bit ahead, we have Bismarck creating the whole idea of the welfare state, basically. So the enlightened conservatives are now, as I say, avatars of centrist liberalism. They're becoming more centrist than they were. They argue with the liberals a little bit on detail, but it's only on detail, how much concessions here and there and so forth.
So the liberals, and you've written this in your book, they, coming out of 1848, saw themselves as closer to the conservatives than they thought. What lesson did they take? What project did they feel they had to undertake, maybe with more vigor than before, as a result of 1848?
Well, basically, they were frightened by the radicals. The radicals before 1848 weren't all that strong and were really sort of just a sort of radical wing of the liberals. And all of a sudden, in France, notably, with the February Revolution, for about 4 months, you get a kind of class struggle for power and radicals really asserting a kind of radical line on the social question. And the liberals say, my God, you know, it's these radicals, which we thought were a small, unimportant fringe, they're really pretty strong and they're really pretty dangerous. And maybe we've got to sort of move our line, to be more anti-radical. So they move towards the conservative position briefly in the sense of sustaining repression of various kinds in France, in Germany, in Poland, and so forth. They move away from a de facto alliance with what they used to think of as small, unimportant radicals, and now they see them as a kind of major threat. So they want to kind of assert a strong control position. And the radicals draw a conclusion, which is curious. They say, look, you know, what were radicals in 1848? They were, there was a lot of spontaneism in their approach, and they thought if they sort of yelled and shouted at appropriate points, they'd make progress, and they saw that that didn't work. And the lesson that the radicals drew from this is we've got to organize. Revolution isn't made in a day. You have to create the structures that will allow us to be revolutionaries. But organization, you see, is also a way of postponing things. You spend a lot of time organizing, preparing the way, educating, etc., etc., etc. And in the end, that turns into becoming an avatar of the centrist liberals. So there you are. Everybody draws a lesson from 1848, which creates the situation of locating the basic political drive in terms of slow, steady progress controlled by specialists, by people who are skilled managers of change, which is what centrist liberalism is all about. And we go on like that for quite a while.
You were saying earlier how the French Revolution describes sovereignty as belonging to the people. And in that way, it sort of defined what the nation or what was considered national was. Now, at a certain point, workers in the 19th century began to think in terms of nation. They began to identify with the nation in which they live. They saw foreigners as competitors, as economic competitors. Tell us more about that and the impact of that identification of many workers with nation.
Well, one of the things is when you organize, where do you organize? What's the lever of change? So they begin to say, in effect, well, we organize within the national boundaries. We are the workers of X state, and we want to change that state, right? So that creates a sort of identification, and this is one of the moderating features of workers organizing. They become, and again, to this day, right? So workers are organized to change their situation in their state, and they essentially see workers in other states as in some way competitive with them. So workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains is a very nice slogan, but not if you've organized workers' parties, which are all national parties. You know, let me put in a word about the French Revolution. Along with Volume 4, the first three volumes have also been republished with new prologues, and Volume 3 spends a lot of time, about 25% of it, is on the French Revolution. And it's important to put that into this context, because in Volume 3, I basically try to argue against the dominant positions on the French Revolution, which was that it changed the political structure of France, that it changed the economic situation of France. I'm saying both of those things are absolutely wrong. The political structure didn't get basically changed. I'm a Tocquevillian. Basically, the French Revolution was continuing the whole process of national integration that was started centuries before by Colbert and so forth. And economically, it isn't that it brought capitalism to France. France had been part of the capitalist system for 2.5 centuries already. So my argument in Volume 4 is that unlike the mainstream arguments about the French Revolution, that it made major changes in the political system and major changes in the economic situation, is no, it made no major changes in either of those, but it made major changes in the world cultural situation, what I call the geoculture. And all of what we've been talking about today is a description of what happens in that geoculture.
Emmanuel Wallerstein joins me. He is a senior research scholar at Yale University and the author of The Modern World System, the fourth volume of which has just come out from University of California Press. Its title is Centrist Liberalism Triumphant, 1789 to 1914. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. And if the French Revolution did not represent the overthrow of feudal elements by the bourgeoisie paving the way for France to become a capitalist country, when should we understand capitalism first making an appearance in France and elsewhere, its origins?
The origins are in the 16th century. That's volume one of the modern world system, right? So I argue that from the beginning, what we're doing is the creation of a world economy, a world not in the sense of global, but a world, not the world, but a world, whose boundaries in the 16th century were roughly what we would today call Western, Southern Europe, parts of it, and parts of the Americas. That was the world economy. The world economy then expands until by the middle of the 19th century, it's going to cover the entire globe. But what we call France is part of this from the beginning and a very central part of the creation. So France is part of a capitalist world economy from the long 16th century, as is England, as is the Low Countries, as is Spain and Portugal and so forth. So capitalism doesn't come country by country. It comes to something which I call the world economy, and that's the modern world system is a capitalist world economy, comes into existence in the long 16th century, and is in its crisis stage today. Of course, systems don't last forever. They come into existence, they have a normal life, and then they come into structural crisis. That's true of all systems. That's true of the universe as the largest system that we know. It's true of infinitesimal systems, the tiniest ones. They all have lives. They're never eternal.
And let me just clarify, by the long 16th century, Emmanuel Wallerstein, my guest, means the years roughly 1450 to 1640. Let's talk about Egypt, and there's a danger here because we are taping this program a few days before it actually airs, but of course, no one can ignore the tremendous unrest and protest in Tahrir Square and elsewhere in Egypt, the dissatisfaction with the military-led government. Does it make sense, Emmanuel, to apply any framework that emphasizes the role of centrist liberalism to an authoritarian state that continues to crack down and brutalize opposition movements?
Well, what happened in Egypt is typically what happens when you have a radical uprising in the last 30, 40 years, right? So we get a very strong movement coming together of many people in Tahrir Square, and it gets focused on the state and the incarnation of the state in the president, his corruption, his ruthlessness, etc., etc., his awful foreign policy, all these issues, and it's strong enough so that the people in power say, well, we've got to sacrifice the president. Who cares? We'll depose him, but let's try to take over this thing, in this case by the army. One way of doing that is to say the army is neutral, the army is on your side, the army is taking over and reestablishing a new situation, which will be, again, centrist, because now we're going to have slow progress towards an improved situation. And after a few weeks, the people in Egypt say, we're being had. And they are. So we are now into the second wind of this, and they're saying, the army's taken over, but they're doing the same thing. It's after all, this guy, Tantawi, he was the Minister of Defense, I think it was called, under Mubarak. I mean, it's the same group, and he's got around him all the same group, and they're doing the same things. We don't have Mubarak, that's true, but we haven't really improved our situation. But what the army is using is the language of centrist liberalism. They're promising progress. Oh, yeah, well, we're going to have a new constitution. Of course, it'll have a few clauses in it about the right of the army to control the situation. And we're going to have new elections. Of course, of course, of course. Don't worry. And now order is important and so forth. So, yes, it's perfectly possible to apply the concept of centrist liberalism as the idea of controlled moderate change, but controlled by the specialists, the people who know, not by ignorant people in the street. What do they know and what do they want? But we'll give them what they should have and will have eventually.
Is it fair to say that the Egyptian government has successfully co-opted the Muslim Brotherhood to date?
Well, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, it's a group with a long, long history and a lot of strength, right, who were repressed, it is true, but not totally, under Mubarak, and who have been waiting their turn. Now, they're not the only Muslim movement in Egypt. There are at least two important other Muslim movements which are much more, open to new things. The Muslim Brotherhood is trying to co-opt the situation. They were annoyed at the army briefly because they thought the army was trying to exclude them, but they've sort of now made a kind of deal with the army and they're now joining the army, but they have to control their own people because they have younger people who are more radical. So it's a fluid situation, but the Muslim Brotherhood is not a force for radical social change in Egypt. That is quite clear, and they are a co-optative force.
All right, and let's get back to the Occupy movement. And you, earlier this hour, really put it nicely into the context of what you were talking about, the people who feel excluded and want to be included and given rights and privileges that they see that only a small percentage of the people in this country having. Where do you think the Occupy movement goes from here? What kind of momentum has it built? And, you know, a lot of people look at all these camps being cleared and think, well, this doesn't look good for the future, the immediate future, the cold future with winter coming on of this movement.
The Occupy movement is, first of all, it's a worldwide movement. I mean, we call it the Occupy movement in the United States and maybe Canada, and you call it by other names in other countries. But basically, there's a worldwide movement now. And yes, winter is always a problem for these movements. And I see it sort of as phase one was terribly successful, remarkably successful. I wrote an essay called The Fantastic Success of Occupy Wall Street. And they lasted much longer initially than anyone thought at the outset they would, because they actually seemed so strong that the authorities hesitated to be too repressive. And then the authorities, obviously in a fairly coordinated way in the United States, actually decided, now is the moment. Let's clear them out, and winter's coming on, and we can really kill this movement now. And they've tried that. So we've got the repression, which is significant and has occurred all over the United States, with one or two exceptions. And the Occupy Wall Street movement is in much internal discussion about what to do and what to do next. One of the things that's happened, of course, is that the Occupy movement, which was an urban movement and not particularly a student movement, has suddenly moved on to the campuses, which is where it was heavily in 68. And on the campuses, you don't have to do it by necessarily by occupying lawns where you set up tents to sleep overnight. You can occupy buildings. That's what they did in 68. And you may see some of that. I think they're in a second wind here in Egypt. They've had a general strike in Lisbon, in all over Portugal, that practically closed down the country for a day. They've just had a major strike occurring now in London, which is going to cut Heathrow's traffic by 50%, which is fantastic, and so forth. So it's not easy, but I think we're going to see it take different forms now in the U.S. and elsewhere in Europe and moving into all sorts of places. I mean, people don't even talk about the fact that there were successful strikes inside China. The stuff going on in South Africa, I just was reading this morning about what is again going on in Chile and the tensions between their student-led movement and the national government. So I hesitate to predict in detail, but I think the Occupy movement worldwide is into its second wind. It's not over, not at all, and the second wind has to take more imaginative forms. I would say, notice that as you look around the world, the resurgence and re-radicalization of the trade unions everywhere. That's not just the United States. That's true in almost any country you name, including Egypt, and including Tunisia, but including South Africa and so forth. So we're getting a kind of worker base that's very important to the future of this movement.
Emmanuel Wallerstein, former distinguished professor of sociology at Binghamton University, author of The Modern World System, a classic three-volume study of the emergence of capitalism, which has recently been republished alongside a brand new fourth volume. We have links on againstthegrain.org to Emmanuel and his books. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's a reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, and consider visiting us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Mike Biggs, who's at the controls today.